So welcome everyone. Thank you for coming tonight. Can everybody hear me? It's a little noisy tonight. Can you hear me in the back? It's okay. If you can't, just kind of do that along the way. Is there anybody here tonight who is the first time or new? Oh, okay. So usually what we do is, even though I will be teaching and commenting on a traditional text, we always take time in the beginning for questions. So if anyone has any questions about the meditation practices that we've done here tonight, or any questions about kind of what's going on here that doesn't make sense, or, you know, if in your own life you've been trying to apply the teachings of mindfulness, the teachings of the Buddha's Dharma to your life and to the reality and situations, the challenges of life. And if anything is not clear to you, please feel very open and free to ask any question you want. Right. So that invitation goes for everyone, not just for people who are new tonight. It's very important that these practices and teachings be very clear to us, not only in our capacity to understand what they're about, but also, more importantly, is how to apply them in our life so we get benefit. Benefit means that there is real healing and transformation, diminution of suffering, and development of the capacities of the heart and mind to lead a wise, intelligent, compassionate, etc. Type of life. So having said that, does anyone have any questions? And please don't be shy. Yes. And your name is?
Peter,
yes, Peter.
Thank you. I've been looking at different. I've been to. This is my second Sangha this week. And one of the problems I have in my life is to have a solid decision making process. So when I'm trying to choose a Sangha, if you will, I don't know if. You know, it's exactly what to look for, or something mm-hmm. that resonates with me. Or.
Yeah. I'm just going to repeat the question for the... So the question is...
Choosing a sangha,
basically shopping around. And lots of people these days are shopping around, and not just in the Buddhist marketplace, but in the so-called spiritual marketplace. There's a lot available. Right, and it can be overwhelming. It can be confusing because the range of choices that we in America have today is not what people had traditionally. I mean, traditionally you grew up in these cultures, and basically there were teachers nearby, and so one usually accessed the teaching, the monastery, the temple, the master who was nearby. Or else within the culture, reputation, so you knew where to go. But these days it's very confusing because, there's just so much accessible. I'm not even talking about, real sanghas, but through the internet and, bookstores. I mean, we can just overwhelm ourselves with endless teachings and they can, this one says we're the right way and that one says no, we're the right way. And this one says this is the highest and this is the lowest and, it's nonsense. Okay. I think the first thing is you want to be authentic with yourself. Right? What is really motivating me and driving me in my spiritual search? I call it that, but we could call it whatever, which means we have to be very real about what is my suffering that I am seeking relief from, and what is the yearnings of my heart that I'm that I yearn to realize in my life, which is really what kind of human being do I want to be, and not some what kind of human being do I want to be in some abstract, but in real, real in my life, in my relationships, in my work. How do I want to manifest in this world? in a very concrete, clear way. All right? So now you have at least some personal criteria. So when you go shopping around, does it speak to me? And not just speak to me in any kind of intellectual abstract way, but really to what I'm dealing with in my life. It's funny. I'm retired now, but in my years, I used to be a psychotherapist. And, of course, I'd have friends or acquaintances, who I wouldn't see. But they'd say to me, how do you go out and choose, a therapist? And I'd say, you make an appointment with them, and you meet them. And there's obviously some sort of personal connection or response that you feel, a comfortability or a trust or whatever in the person. But I would also say, you know why you're going, right? And you shouldn't feel reluctant to ask this person you're going to, this is my problem. Can you help me? And then to ask them, if they say yes, to say, how would you go about it, right? And have you experience in working with people like me? So it's very practical, you know what I'm saying? I think in this way, a combination of those feeling qualities, personal feelings of comfortability, of whatever, but also in a very practical sense of meeting your needs. What else? Again, it's a very bizarre situation, because, like, let's say you're interested in Buddhism. I mean, not only do you access Buddhism, but you access, because in the 2,500 years of the Buddhist tradition, it's gone to many, many different countries. Within each of those countries, it's taken on the cultural formations of those countries, as well as it's divided into sects and subsects and traditions, and they're all here now, right? It used to be, when I started out, you used to have to go to Asia to get it. But now you can just walk around the block, and you can get Tibetan Buddhism and Japanese Buddhism and Soto and Rinzai and all the 25 sects of Tibetan Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism, right? And it's like restaurants, right? Chinese restaurants, French restaurants, fast food, gourmet food, you know what I mean? So how do you choose a restaurant? But again, so there are criteria for teachers in terms of their experience and et cetera, et cetera. But that being said, and that's certainly to understand a teacher and what their training is and et cetera, et cetera. It's eventually trust. Trust. Are there any other questions about practice? Yes, Salima.
I practice impermanence.
You practice impermanence.
I practice non-attachment.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a hard time practicing and understanding the absence of self.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's not a simple question. But they all relate. The question. So the question is, I practice impermanence in my daily life. I practice non-attachment in my daily life. And I guess you're saying you have some success with that. But you're saying then there's this practice of non-self. That's like it's more of a challenge. Yeah. Good. I'm glad you're challenged by it. If we find it practice too easy for us, we're not really practicing. Right? I mean, Dharma, true Dharma, is a 180 from the way we normally perceive things. I mean, that's the Buddha's message. It's a very radical message, right? Because what? Because in ordinary life, we see things as permanent, right? Things appear permanent. The senses seem to reveal things are permanent. So to really see that things are impermanent, that everything's in a process of changing, is to look at things very differently and to relate to things very differently. In the same way that things appear solid, and yet upon investigation they're all composites, made up of things, interdependent. So we can see that Dharma, the view of Dharma, the teachings of Dharma, and the realizations of Dharma all turn us around. Right? It's because they turn us around in a very fundamentally good way that we practice non-attachment. See, one can practice non-attachment as a practice, right? But it's much better to practice non-attachment because we see that things are not worthy of being attached to. Right? Understand. Right? To understand that because of the nature of things, because things are impermanent, subject to change, right? Not solid, right? Made up of everything else, composites, etc., etc. And because, even more importantly, are not the basis of happiness and satisfaction. But actually, the attachment to thing and the clinging to things is really more often causes us dissatisfaction, unhappiness, dukkha, suffering. Right? So, because of our understanding, naturally comes non-attachment. Is that clear? Or else we're always struggling. Attaching, you know, attaching and then kind of peeling the fingers off to let go. But if I know that this is something unworthy of attaching to, that it is just what it is, right? It has no permanent validity or reality. It's only mine in name, right? But truly, this is not mine, is it? And my happiness or unhappiness, even though this is a good book, in the greater scheme of things, whether I have it or don't have it really doesn't relate deeply to my own happiness and well-being, peace of mind. Actually being attached to it disturbs the mind, because if I potentially am concerned about losing it, it will cause me disturbance or some anxiety, right? So impermanence, suffering, composite nature of things. And then the other really hard one for us, I think, as Westerners, is this whole, again, fundamental view or teaching or understanding, going back to the Buddha, of non-self. But it really relates to the other two. Impermanence, composite, right? That there's nothing solid here, right? There's nothing solid in anything. Everything is made up of parts, right? Everything in the coming together of the parts are just temporary. And this doesn't just relate to books and tape recorders and watches and glasses, right? This relates to bodies, including my body and your body. This is their nature. Right? The body is just made up of many, 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 many parts that are all in the process of changing and will one day from dust to dust is the nature of the body. Because of the impermanent nature of the body and the composite of the body, it is worthy of being cared for because it is a good vehicle for our life. But it is not something to be attached to. Because if we attach to it, if we try to attach to something that is basically unstable and is always in a process of change and transformation, our attachment can only lead to what? Suffering. Unhappiness, dissatisfaction, sadness, grief, etc. Right? Now, self, because in America, the self and the ego is really more what we call it, is front and center, right? And the centrality of self, the centrality of me and my, the centrality of I, is highly nurtured, right, in this society, through language, through child rearing practices, and through popular culture, right? And then along comes Buddhism and Buddha Dharma that says what? The self is really a non-self. Now that's very important to understand, because Buddhism doesn't negate the appearance of a self, nor does Buddhism negate the appearance of a book, or a recorder, or a watch, or a or glasses, or a body, right? Because in the world of appearances, right, which is a common sense relative world, we see what? Would anybody not say there are bodies in this room, right? And does not everybody in here have a name that was given to it, right? And in our common language of things, we talk about Fred's book, Fred's glasses, Fred's watch, Fred's recorder, or maybe it's Alex's recorder, right? So we do talk this way, and we do label that way. But it is only when we look deeper we find, such is the case of the self, that no solid thing called the self can be ever found. And this is not metaphysical, this is not spiritual babble. This is something that's readily investigated and the truth of it found out by anybody who takes the time to look. Right? So I say such a thing as, this is my body, right? Do we all not talk this way? No, I mean, which is a statement of self. My body. And yet the truth is, that which is called my, which claims this body as its own, cannot be found. I mean, does anybody believe that they have a thing inside them that owns this body and is separate from this body and owns it? I mean, does anybody here think they made their body? I guess that could be a way of claiming ownership. Who made your body? None of us made our own body, did we? Anybody here think they made their body? Who made your body? Your parents made your body. Your ancestors made your body. It's not your body. Right? I may claim this is my book, but I just bought this book. I didn't make this book, right? It's not my book. My book is just a temporary reference, right? That at this point it happens to be in my possession. In the same way this body temporarily happens to be, but even to say my possession I have a relationship with this body, and I need to take care of it. But it's not my body. My parents made this body. And this body has a life of its own, doesn't it? It has grown a certain way. And it is moving in a certain way. And it is being in the process of dissolution according to its own circumstances. Again, how I feed it, how I take care of it may have something to do with, you know, how it feels and how long it lives and how healthy it is or not. But this body has a life of its own. It is a marvelous, wondrous thing of many, 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 many intersecting parts, right? All miraculously working with each other in all kinds of states, right? But it's not my body. Because my name is Fred, that Fred cannot be found, right? For example, and this is scientific, your name again is... All right, Peter. So Peter would say, this is Peter, look around the room. Which body is yours? All right, so Peter, common sense, Peter, right? But Peter, if we did an autopsy on your body and took every piece apart, would we find something called Peter? No. So calling it Peter's body is convenient, right? And it denotes a certain kind of relationship. But when we look deeply, nothing called Peter can be found in his body. Now let's. But then somebody might say, "Ah, well, okay, I'll give you that one. But how about my mind?" Right? Because most of us would say, "Well, you know, who's Fred? He's a body and a mind, right?" Or am I missing something? Isn't this the way we talk? Body, mind. No. So if we were to look in our mind, which is worth looking into, if we're investigating it, we would look into our mind. We're on the search for an entity, a permanent solid entity called Fred, in your case called Peter. Now, Peter, if you looked into your mind, would you find some entity called Peter? No. Well, that's fascinating. And it's not just fascinating, my friends, you know, to prove a point, you know, right? It's fascinating because if you look at how we run our lives, especially our emotional life, our relationship life, the way we act, the way we view, it's all based on what? Self. Right? Advancing self, defending self, protecting self, right? Getting self's needs met. The whole, you know, why do we get angry? Try to get angry without a self. Try to be scared without a self. Anxious, worried, impatient, hurt. It's very hard to have an active emotional life without the centrality of a self that's very concerned about how it's perceived and how it's respected and how its needs right. And yet, when you look into your body and look into your mind, you cannot find that self. You might find what when you look in your mind? Anybody look in their mind here? I know we have people here who meditate. When you look in your mind, what do you find? I mean, this is not a trick question. Well, thoughts. Are thoughts permanent? Do thoughts have substance? Try to grab a thought. Thoughts are composite. Thoughts are made up of what? Words. Words are made up of what? Letters, sounds. Right? There's nothing solid there. They're just thoughts. There is an I thought. There is a Fred thought. There is a me and a mind thought. Those are thoughts. But they're not real in any intrinsic sense, are they? So we look in our mind and we find what? Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories. Lots of activity. All of which come and go. Nothing stable. Nothing solid. Like flowers in air, it says in the teaching. Like flowers in air. Right? Flowers in air, they what? They appear. But when you try to grab them, there's nothing. Thoughts seem solid, don't they? Especially the I thoughts, the me thoughts. We constrict around them, we grab around them. We create lots of emotional drama. But if you step back in mindfulness and look, observe and look deeply, thoughts just disappear. Now, the problem is we are habituated to believing, identifying with each of us as our own self. It's an identity that has been nurtured by our families, by society, and when we kind of got old enough and developed enough cognitive capacity, we reinforced. So now we are deeply wedded to the thoughts of who we are. But when you meditate deeply on this, again, this is not catechism, this is not dogma. This is readily available to anyone, any of us here, who look deeply, which is what meditation is. Meditation is learning how to look deeply into one's own experience, one's own mind, to discover the truth of reality, such as, right? Is Salima a convenient designation for that? Or is there really a Salima, right, who's really running the show? Can you find her central control room? Because she certainly acts like she has one, doesn't she? Right? Everybody thinks they got this central control room, right, where Fred lives, and he's got his all his little stuff in front of him, his video cameras and his, right, and he's controlling everything. That's the way we act. But when we look deeply, we cannot find that. And then that, that's a big deal, isn't it? Especially if we have erected our life on this identification of oneself as something. You know, in the opening gatha that Andrew recited, it talked about superiority complex, inferiority complex, and equality complex. It's the same thing. You know, we have this way of identifying who we are. And based on our history and childhood, et cetera, some of us think we're great. Some of us think we're less than great. Right? And some of us think we're as good as everybody else. Those are all identifications, aren't they? The truth is, we just are who we are. We are, but they say who we are, what we are. We're a series of what? Thoughts, feelings, behaviors, memories, all coming together, put together, manifesting in the moment. Right? But we perceive it as something solid. It's because we perceive it as something solid, our identification, our ego, our self as something solid, and our emotions as solid, and thoughts as solid, and everything it feels, and especially, you know, when you're in it. You know what I'm saying? When you're in your drama, when you're in your drama of self, and it all seems so solid and real, right? He said this to me, and that I'm feeling, right? It all seems so solid. That's called suffering, dukkha. But when you see the whole thing as something just very different, right? Things just arising and passing according to causes and conditions, nothing solid, nothing permanent, right? And you're able to meet all these arisings of life with openness and mindfulness, spaciousness, compassion and understanding, it's a very different ballgame than the drama of self, which is a very tight, constricted. It's a struggle. It wears you out. Right? People get exhausted from their self-created dramas and the conflicts, misunderstandings, right, that it creates and makes things. It makes it hard to have a happy life. The drama of self. So again, going back to the Buddha himself and 2,500 years of Buddha's teaching, understanding deeply the impermanent nature of phenomena, understanding deeply the empty, non-composite nature of phenomena, all phenomena, physical phenomena, mental phenomena, right? Understanding that happiness and meaning cannot be found in things, but that actually attachment and aversion leads to suffering. And finally, that there's no intrinsic self in any real way. When we have meditated on this deeply, reflected on this deeply, then non-attachment arises very simply. In the same way, if we look in our cabinet because we're thirsty and there's something, there's a drink that's labeled poison, it wouldn't hopefully be a struggle not to pick it up, even if you're thirsty, right? Because you know what? It will not, not only will it not satisfy my thirst, but it will create suffering for me. The more we practice, the more we meditate and reflect deeply, we understand that same thing about lots of types of experiences and lots of types of ways of reacting and dealing with things that we're habitually used to. When we can, in mindfulness, we can see more clearly. We understand, you know, that's a poisonous emotional road to go down. That's a poisonous thought road to go down. That's a drama that only creates suffering for myself and others, right? So one sees that more clearly over time. But if we're totally ensnared in the drama of self, if we're totally ensnared in the drama of permanence, and if we're totally ensnared that we think things and getting things, whether these things are physical things, or consumer things, a relationship, identification, a label, you know, as long as we think that, you know, happiness and meaning and et cetera will come from that kind of acquisition, you know, we're going to keep the drama going. But when we see clearly, things change. And again, it doesn't mean you know, that you you know, that you don't then go into, you know, you don't then work, you know, have careers, or you don't advance, or you don't get degrees, or you don't you know, try to advance yourself, and you know, all that kind of stuff. You can still do all that, but it's a much lighter way. It's more playful. It's not as grasping and serious. Is that? Yeah, so the practice of non-self and reflecting on it is important. It's at the root of things. Actually, last night I met with the St. Pete Sangha. And I think it was an answer to some question. But what came to my mind is, you know, if you did a list, you know, across the board, you know about the eye, you know, like the eye, all the eye's likes, all the eye's dislikes, all the eye's needs and wants, and all the that list could be thousands of things, right? Thousands on this side. But on this side, there's only one thing, the I. You know, if you deal with all of these, you get a big list, get a lot of work. But you deal with the I, the central mover, and get this one straight, you take care of a lot. Right. And that's the problem that people do. You know, in Buddhism it's said, you know, in the Zen, in the Dzogchen teachings, it's said, you know, don't, you know, most people, we're always working at the external side, you know, at the leaves, always pruning the leaves. Trouble with pruning the leaves is what? They grow back. And so we're always, you know, working circumstance to circumstance, situation to situation, right? And we may be able to, you know, to do something in each situation, right? But then it just keeps coming back. It keeps coming back. It keeps coming back. Different situations, you know, the same kind of things arise. But when you deal with this more fundamental, these fundamental of self, self-identity, permanence, you know, these kinds of things we're talking about, then it's sort of like you really kind of get all this just by getting a few big things over here. Does that make sense to you? Coming back to the analogy with the tree, again, you know, if the tree is, you know, let's say the tree, we're calling it the self and all the manifestations of self. You know, if the tree is the problem, you know what I'm saying? Like, let's say you got a house and there's a beautiful view, but there's a big tree. Right? So you can't, you don't ever get the big expansive view, right? Because the tree's there. Well, you say, you know, I got to go do something. So we get out there and we what? We trim off a couple of branches, we trim off some leaves, and what? We get a little better view. 2-3 months later, what? It's all grown back. Once again, no view. And that's many people, we practice that way. We're always trimming things up. Right? Get ourselves stuck, and we get ourselves unstuck. Right? Stuck, unstuck. Stuck, you know, fall down, pick ourselves up. Fall down, pick ourselves up. Fall down. Right? Endlessly. Same stuff over and over again. If the tree's the problem and you want the view, what? Go to the root. Take it out. And then you have a beautiful view all the time. Right? Much simpler. So again, what we're saying is there are lots of practices that cut away leaves and cut away branches. Right? And so it'll give it, you know, it's like you don't really have the real big view, but then you kind of see it, you know. You kind of see the sky or see the mountains in the distance because you cut some stuff away. And that's good. But if you really want the view, the expansive view, cut down the tree. Which means you got to get to the trunk, you got to get to the root, cut it out. And luckily, again, you know, there are spiritual teachings, practices that are very attested and used for thousands of years. I mean, it's not like we have to reinvent the wheel or make anything up. You know, we just need to I mean, what's going on in terms of Buddhism is, we, as Americans, we have our own unique culture, we have our own unique idiom, and we have our own unique challenges, right, as Americans, personal, cultural. Buddhism in a creative way has to be brought into the American culture, brought into the American idiom, and manifested in ways that speak directly to the needs of us as we are today. But otherwise, so the application is a little creative in this day and somewhat experimental, but the actual teachings and practices themselves, you know, are time-tested for thousands of years. Because the basic human experience has not changed. Any other questions? Or maybe somebody wants to challenge me. That's fine, too. I could be talking nonsense. And if I am, please straighten me out. Yes.
My question is also about self. And,
And what?
Body and self, both. Since I have my baby, I noticed I'm other babies. I'm just four babies. I'm not more than before. And, you know, they're always with you, and I compliment them to the matters.
I'm having just trouble hearing you. This is on the noise. So just speak up a little bit.
I'll get
it.
Been a couple of weeks ago, and I realized that the only reason I ask this question, the second question, is to see how old the baby is, so I can see how the mother looks like. Is she not all the way? Is she not better than I? And it was very, when I realized what I was doing, you know, in all the innocence, I was like really stunned by like all these months since January I've been doing this. Like, you know, about twice a week at least or more, and I never seen it until my mother didn't look better than me.
Well, that is the question, you see. You're exactly right. So the question is, the question competing for this, someone says she's a new mother, and since she's been a new mother, she's much more attentive to babies, and not only much more attentive to babies, but also attentive to babies' mothers, and then even more attentive to comparisons. How do baby mothers look? And how are they looking compared to me and my body? Right? So, self. This is very interesting. See, because, and it all makes sense, because you see, self in any true intrinsic way does not exist. Okay? It is a fabrication. But to convince itself it exists, it has to latch on to something. And one of the most obvious things it latches on to is what? The body. Right? So in Buddhism we talk about psychology, name and form. Right? So self manifests through name, Elzbieta, and all the way Elzbieta identifies herself, you know. But one of the big ways she identifies herself is with her body, right? And again, that can be, as we were told earlier, that can be, I got the most beautiful body in the world, nicer than anybody else, right? I got the most ugliest body in the world, worse than anybody else, or my body's as good as anybody's body, right? So it'll take a stance, or all kind of permutations in there, right? Shame, pride, all that. Not. If I said to you, Elzbieta, does your body care about how it looks? No. Okay, let's get clear. It doesn't come from the body, right? Bodies are just bodies, aren't they? So bodies don't care how they look, do they? Bodies don't think, what are people thinking about me, right? So what is that? Right? That goes beyond just acknowledging a caretaking role with the body, right? But that it actually becomes a extension of self, right? An identification of self. And what I would say to you, Elzbieta, you're absolutely right. That which is so identified with that body cannot be found. And yet, in the moment, it arises like you say. Why does it arise that way? Again, you know your life. This is the way hopefully all of us know our life. And so we can see the causes and conditions that have brought us to this point where we have such not only identification with our body, but also with a certain kind of body, right? And then our self-esteem and our worth and comparison and judgment and all this stuff. It's just more and more, right? You know that one. You know what we call that? The Buddha called that. Called that suffering. Suffering. That all that whole thing is just suffering. Right? All comparison. Cause suffering. Suffering doesn't only mean like tears and sadness. Anything that disturbs the equanimity of the mind is a kind of suffering. Anything that disturbs our equanimity is a kind of suffering. Right? Because it's not there without the comparison. It's not there without the judgment. Right? And the judgmental, again, comes from this overweening identification of self and body. Again, coming back to where we talked earlier, meditating on the body, on its impermanent composite nature, helps us really understand what we talked about earlier, right? You are not your body. Your body, you know, I mean, Elzbieta, I look at you and I say, oh, there's Elzbieta. But that's not true. I see your mother and your father. They made your body, right? Right? And even to say your mother and father, it's really their grand, you know, it's ancestors. So when we look in the mirror, we shouldn't, if we look deeply, we don't see ourself, right? When I look in the mirror, I don't see Fred. Fred, that's just a name for this. This is the body of my ancestors, right? How I look is what? It's not about me, is it? So we want to see how our attachment and identification causes us to suffer. We also want to see that it is kind of delusional. Right? And then we want to change, to let go. You know, there's a wonderful practice, you know, in the teachings on love, the four measurables. The third one is taking joy in the joy of others. It's a wonderful practice because it is the opposite of comparison and jealousy. So when you look at somebody and they are more beautiful than you, rather than going, you know what I mean? You go, how wonderful that they have a beautiful body. And look how wonderful it is that she's recovered so well from her pregnancy. I'm happy for her. Right? Joy in the joy of others. It's the opposite of the ego way of doing it, which is, you know, how come I don't look better than her? You see, that's where the ego goes, right? How come not me? You know, me first, me best. The ego's always looking around because it's pathetic. I don't mean like you're pathetic. The ego is pathetic. If you stop and listen to it, it's just pathetic. You know, I mean, if you really just step back, it's immature. It has totally materialistic values. It just makes a big deal about nothing. Right? You know, it's pathetic. So in that sense, you know, we just gotta, you know, like when she gets that way, just come here. Yeah, she has a nicer body than you do. It's okay. Just calmer, and it's not a big deal. Right? You know, and we have to, we have a lot of bad habits, bad ways of thinking about things. You know? So you go to, you see, my sense is, you know, it's like everybody here is here, and you're listening to Dharma, right? You're listening to teachings tonight. But if you just stop there, it won't do much for you. See, you have to, like Elzbieta, you got to go home because you got somebody else inside you. You know her? And she doesn't get it, does she? You see? So you got to teach her Dharma. So when she's in that comparison, judging, attached way, you kind of call her over to you. You know her well. You can speak to her in Polish, right? And you teach her some Dharma so she can grow up, so she can mature. Just like that. You don't have to get angry with yourself or disgusted with yourself, you know what I mean, or all that stuff. That's the same of making a big deal about it. Just, oh, that's interesting. You know? And then, again, don't be overwhelmed. I can't believe, you know, that I'm so attached or I'm so vain, you know. I mean, a lot of people go, I can't believe it. But of course you can believe it, right? Because it's true, isn't it? About a part of you. And that's another thing. You know, a lot of times we get into the spiritual path and we're kind of disgusted or let down by these other parts of ourselves, you know, that sort of, you know, because we think we're what? You know, I'm a meditator. I'm on a spiritual path, right? Somebody as great as me doesn't deserve to have, you know, these little egocentric parts of, you know, vain, self-glorious, self-righteous parts, right? Not somebody like me, right? But unfortunately, what? These parts are part of us, right? And we need to liberate them from their suffering. That's our job, right? So don't be in denial, but on the other hand, don't be disgusted. You know, this is the practice of transformation that we're all involved in. So when these parts of you come up, you know, strongly, that's good. Oh, now you see clearly that part of you, right? She needs some help. She needs some dharma. She needs some, you know, maybe she's got issues around her body. You know what I'm saying? And shame issues. Or, you know what I mean? Who knows? You know what I'm saying? So there may be things that you need to help her with. So in that sense, when this stuff comes up, you know, it's good. We feel good in this practice. So when our darkness is present to us, that's good. Because now we see clearly and we know what the work we need to do. And okay?